Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, parents, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, interrupt, and sometimes disrupt our daily lives. For decades, school vaccination requirements have quietly protected millions of children from once devastating diseases like polio, measles, and whooping cough. But today, those protections are being reexamined. Here in Florida, the Department of Health had a public forum to discuss possible changes to school immunization requirements, raising important questions for families, educators, and students alike. At the same time, vaccination rates among children are declining nationwide. Even as a bipartisan poll shows strong public support for vaccines and concern about what these declines mean for public health. Joining us today on 411 Team is Candace DeMatteis, Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at the Partnership to Fight Infectious Diseases. She is here to help us understand what families need to know, why vaccination rates matter, and how to separate fact from fiction in an age of widespread misinformation. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. I welcome Candace DeMatteis. She joins us via Zoom from North Carolina. Candace, welcome to 411 Team.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Candace, what should families understand about why Florida's Department of Health is revisiting school vaccination requirements now?
You ask a great question, and that is, why are we revisiting this when we've had so much success, as you mentioned in your intro, in that quiet vaccination plan that's been in place, mandates across Florida and across many states across the U.S. that have kept generations safe from infectious diseases that once plagued us? And the answer that I hear from most experts is really more political. There are no new safety signals. There's no new safety concerns about vaccines. So it really comes down to more of a political issue than a health issue, sadly.
Okay. For listeners who may think these diseases are a thing of the past, will you share what's the real risk of polio, measles, and whooping cough today? I mean, there's a measles outbreak now in, what, South Carolina?
Yes, yes, right across the border from me, right. As a matter of fact,
right.
Yes. The reality is it varies, candidly, depending on the infectious disease you're talking about. Like we had with polio, for example, a disease that my mother talks to me about. Many older Florida residents probably experienced it firsthand in their families or their communities when they were young. Mm-hmm. And it was terrifying and very disabling to people who contracted it and had bad cases of it. But we globally are candidly on the cusp, or at least were when we were making more investments in polio vaccination globally, on the cusp of eradication. And eradication means it's not circulating worldwide. So that's a tremendous example of the power of vaccination on a widespread basis. I personally have a scar from getting a smallpox vaccine when mm-hmm. I was a child. Mm-hmm. My children do not have it. Mm-hmm. Most of your teen listeners probably have never even heard of it.
I have one,
and
too.
You do?
Yes.
But the reason that we don't do that anymore is that is the one disease we have been able to absolutely eradicate from the earth. And so we don't have to worry about that. So tremendous success there with respect to polio and smallpox. Measles is another story. We had Canada recently lost what they call elimination status, and that meant it wasn't circulating on a widespread basis over a 12-month period. And they had held that since 1998 and just lost it this year. Our elimination status in the US dates back to the year 2000. We are at great risk of losing that because this measles outbreaks continue to proliferate around the US and including in South Carolina, as you mentioned. That status is at risk of loss come January of this year. And I think most people would say now, public health experts would say we probably will very likely lose it. Measles is one of the most infectious viruses known to man. If you come in contact with someone, if a person with measles walks into a room of 10 unvaccinated people, 9 out of 10 of those
Yes.
people will get measles. That's how infectious it is. But the vaccine works really well. At 2 doses, 97% effective against preventing measles. And so it's been a huge success story. But as you mentioned, because we've had such success with these vaccinations, they've been in place for a long time. The mandates encourage more people to get vaccinated and vaccinate their children. Our memory, we don't remember how dangerous measles can be because we hadn't seen it. We hadn't really experienced it. We don't remember. I had mumps as a kid. I still remember that. That was awful and super painful. Kids today, you don't even hear about it. You
No.
don't even think about it. So when people talk about, oh, you're at so low risk of contracting hepatitis B or measles or polio, and so what's the harm in not vaccinating? History tells us what the harm is in not vaccinating because these diseases were widespread before we had vaccines, and they caused a lot of harm and permanent damage and even death amongst vulnerable populations, and sadly, children are among the most vulnerable populations.
Candace, how do school vaccination requirements function as a public health tool, not just a school policy?
Well, it's important to realize that school mandates for school vaccination are done at the state level. So each different states will have different requirements. They tend to follow a national recommended schedule and standard, but states determine that. So that's why, like, if Florida changes their rules, that's not going to change rules in my home state of North Carolina, for example. But as we all know, people move around, and even change schools, you may move from one state to another and face different requirements. But how mandates work is that there are many children who go to school. That may not. Maybe they have a pa maybe they have a younger sibling who's not able to be vaccinated yet. Maybe they have a parent undergoing cancer treatment, or heaven forbid, maybe they're undergoing cancer treatment or have an autoimmune condition that makes vaccinations not work as much, or perhaps they can't get vaccinated. So that's why mandates and that large scale vaccination rates really protect not only the individual vaccinated, but it creates a barrier among those who are vulnerable, who maybe can't be vaccinated, aren't old enough, or maybe they have a health condition that prevents them from being vaccinated. So it's not just about you individually, but about the whole community that vaccination protects. One important thing to keep in mind in the measles outbreak going on in South Carolina, because it is in a largely unvaccinated schools, and they're not because they didn't have mandates. It's their charter schools and religious schools that maybe didn't have to comply with the state mandates. But those children, because they have been exposed and aren't unvaccinated, are having to quarantine at home. And since it's measles and there's a long latency period, it could be 7 to 14 days before you show symptoms after exposure. You remain contagious for a good while after you show symptoms. They're staying at home for 21 days. And so mom or dad or grandma or someone is actually having to stay at home with the child as well. So there are broader implications. And can you imagine trying to, if you're a teacher and trying to manage a classroom and you got half of them on quarantine and half in the classroom? Those types of things from a public health standpoint and from a state education standpoint become very important as well to keep in mind.
Well, what happens when even a small number of children go unvaccinated in a school or a district?
Well, it depends. There are certain levels of vaccination rates that public health officials recommend to stop the spread and really to avoid these outbreaks that we're seeing today. Because measles is so highly infectious, that rate is at 95%. So if you think about that, as I mentioned, there are some people who maybe because of a health condition are not eligible to be vaccinated, or it's not they're not may have a contraindication that drops it below 100%, and then you've got a lot of people just avoiding it or saying, I don't want to get vaccinated. So anytime you drop below 95%, you could see spread. All you need is someone, an infected individual, to come in. We are well below 95% in most jurisdictions across the country. And some of these where these outbreaks are, we're at like 80, 85%, some even less than that. Whooping cough is another one. Pertussis or whooping cough, we're seeing really high rates across the country, but Florida in particular is having a significant rise in whooping cough cases this year, with over 1,200 reported just since by late September this year. That is an 81% increase over the year before. And most of the children are under age 9, account for the majority of those cases. So again, when it depends on the disease and how infective it is in terms of the vaccination rate, but anything below, first of all, you're vulnerable if you're unvaccinated. That's important to know. So you're an N of one in that instance. But when it starts circulating in the community and why you continue to see these outbreaks continuing to perpetuate, and we can't, they don't slow down, they stop when they stop finding hosts. These bacteria, these viruses, they don't care. They just are looking for a vulnerable host to multiply and to spread. And that is their job in nature. And they will continue to do it until they run up against that wall of protection from running into vaccinated people who don't get infected and don't spread it.
Okay, well, hold your thoughts. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and this edition is looking at the status of vaccinations. I am talking with Candace Mateus. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and allow me to reintroduce my guest today, Candace D. Mateus, Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at the Partnership to Fight Infectious Disease. Candace, schools have played a long central role in normalizing vaccinations. How does strong public support translate or fail to translate into the school policy?
Well, I think in the past, the public support has translated. You mentioned earlier that we collectively, our collective memory, because vaccines have been so successful, we don't fully appreciate the risks of these diseases. So that when people bring up, potential risks or side effects from vaccines, we don't have anything to compare it to in our memory, in our lived experience. Again, older adults in Florida know very well, and they're a fantastic resource for anyone who has any questions about what it used to be like before vaccines. But I do think, too, that schools play such an important role in a whole host of things. Many people get, there are two hot meals a day. Some children, that the only place they get that is in school. So healthy school lunches, we take health classes, we have physical education as a part of our holistic education as children, and that's so important. And then, you know, learning to not only learning to read and write and arithmetic and the like, but we learned social skills and how to get along with people from different experiences. All of that is an important part of education. And so protecting health and promoting health is an important part of schools and screenings, vaccine mandates and the like all play a role in that as well.
Mm-hmm. What about, how do the questions about freedom and choice and parental rights, how can they coexist with strong overall support for vaccination? Can you address that?
Right. So it is important that people have, and I understand that people want to have a choice. They mm-hmm. want to be able to be informed and make decisions about their health and their children's health. The reality is that poll after poll after poll, including polls in Florida, show that the vast majority of people do support vaccine mandates. The other reality is that I think part of that is based on the fact that people want to know their children are safe, that we want to be free from exposure. We don't allow smoking in schools, for example. We cut down on smoking in restaurants. And that's because we're trying to promote health and eliminate exposure, you know, to things that could harm ourselves. All of that could be seen as an imposition, if you will. Is it an imposition? I'm running late for work. There's a stop sign. I'd really rather not stop.
Right.
But that's part of the social construct, that we follow the rules to keep us all safe. And yes, that's an imposition on my freedom if I want to take it that far. But there are reasons that these rules are in place, and it is to protect my health and the health of and safety of those around me. So I do appreciate that, and I encourage people to talk to their pediatricians, to talk to their personal health care providers when they have questions about vaccines. And I think that's perfectly appropriate. Just anytime you have a medical intervention that's recommended, get the facts, mm-hmm. but get the facts from trusted resources. The bottom line, I think, and one of the most important questions to ask is whether removing vaccine mandates will actually improve the health of children in Florida. The clear answer, and history tells us that answer is no. It absolutely will not improve the health of children in Florida. So why are we doing this? Yeah. And those types of questions are tough and may, you know, anger people. But the bottom line is we all want children to be healthier. And if we can start from that standpoint and have, you know, these discussions considering that, and then again, ask, will removing these mandates make children any healthier? I think we can all come to the conclusion that there are reasons these mandates are in place, and hopefully have a civil discussion about, you know, what the appropriate role is here for government and, you know, for people that do have strong concerns or, you know, need a medical exemption or whatever, how that policy may come into play.
Well, can you explain herd immunity in a way that teens and parents can understand, and why it breaks down when vaccination rates fall?
Great question. And I've also heard it called community immunity, so that might help a little bit to understand. But if you think about it in the sense of a family, and you've got children and maybe one is a baby, so 6 months old, let's say. So mm-hmm. too early to get for the recommended vaccine against measles. And I have, you know, has a five-year-old sibling in kindergarten, brings a friend over. They're all playing together in the house. And that child, the friend, is not vaccinated and has measles. Mm-hmm. That child could, you know, if the family is vaccinated, they're protected, and they're protecting that 6-month-old. But as soon as someone else comes in, that 6-month-old is vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So That's one way of thinking about it. If you have maybe you have a child in a class who's undergoing cancer treatment, and that child cannot be vaccinated because of, the immune compromise position that he or she is in because of the cancer treatment. Everyone in that classroom who is vaccinated is protecting that child from exposure. Because if they come in contact with someone with a disease or an illness, they're not going to bring it back to the classroom where that child is. That's how herd immunity or community works. It's setting up a barrier where we're protected, but we're also creating a ring around, if you will, a protective wall around people on the inside of us who are not eligible to be vaccinated. And we're giving them that extra protection. Because again, viruses need a host to live in and to replicate. And if there are no hosts available or the virus comes in contact with people who aren't vulnerable, that disease is not going to spread. So that's kind of how herd immunity works. And if we have vaccination rates of 95%, disease, it's pretty hard for the virus to find someone to infect in that type of a community. And that's how that works.
So what we're saying also, those who are most at risk are the newborns, the immunocompromised kids, and others who may have go undergoing cancer treatments or whatever, that they are going to really be impacted first, correct?
They are the most
Most
vulnerable, and that's how herd immunity. I mean, anybody's vulnerable who's unvaccinated to getting the disease and spreading it. But if we're vaccinated, those people who aren't eligible to be vaccinated are protected. We protect them because we're not allowing it to spread.
Why do you think vaccines remain one of the few public health issues with they have it's it seems to have broad bipartisan support despite this intense political division elsewhere?
That's right.
I
I
mean,
agree with
okay,
you.
I just went, 'cause that's the way I see it. It seems like, well, folks are saying, hey, look, we need to have vaccines, yet when it comes to the lack of support, there's a intense political division there.
Well, and it's interesting. I think that on a, as you mentioned, on a bipartisan basis, and I think candidly, it gets down to the core. These diseases could care less who you voted for. If you vote at all, you're not eligible to vote. So at our core, it is a nonpartisan issue. And I think majorities on a bipartisan basis, and you've seen this in the polling, are united in terms of they support vaccination, they support even mandates. Both Republicans and Democrats and independents all support mandates. On a majority basis, but there is a very vocal minority that are pushing back, and they have a megaphone right now in Washington, D.C., in our current Secretary of Health and Human Services. There are comments coming from the White House that many would disagree with as well. And then social media, I mean, it's just like they used to say about a rumor. Someone says, gives you a compliment, and it or says has to give 10 compliments or say 10 positive things to overcome one negative on social media. And we've all seen is it's clickbait, something negative, something sensational that draws attention, something like, hey, vaccines have been around for 30 years and they work and they're safe. All true, not exactly going to be shared. So we have so much bad information circulating that it's hard for folks to understand, and it's very confusing. And new parents, they want to do the best by their children. There's so much, it's overwhelming in terms of what you should be doing, what you shouldn't be doing, what you should be feeding, how you should be caring for. And vaccination is one of many things in the mix that can be overwhelming. And that's why we just strongly recommend to talk to your pediatrician, talk to someone who knows you personally, knows your health, has your best interest at heart, and get your health and medical advice from those individuals and not social media, even though it can be hard to tune out.
Well, I know the answer to this, but I'm going to pose the question because I think it's important to hear you say it. We look at what's happening in South Carolina. Why do outbreaks teach us, you know, about how quick, well, I shouldn't say why, what do outbreaks teach us about how quickly, you know, these preventable diseases can return? I mean, we're having outbreaks. There was an outbreak in Texas. It seems like the outbreaks themselves ought to be teaching us about what's happening. I mean, is
That's
my
right.
reasoning yeah. wrong? I mean, tell me if I'm not thinking about this in the right way.
No, you're absolutely thinking about it in the right way. Part of the challenge is there are some different things going on too. There's something called survivor bias. Mm-hmm. Well, I had measles when I was, you know, born in the 1950s and I had measles and fine. You know, so there's that can downplay the risk of these diseases when in fact one in five kids ends up hospitalized who gets measles. That's how serious it is. It's a serious respiratory virus. Some people conflate measles with chickenpox and think, oh, it's just a rash, which it's not. So there's that too. People downplay the risks of these diseases. But you're absolutely right that history tells us what's going to happen if vaccination rates continue to decline. And it's not even history, it's now with mm-hmm. measles. Measles, right. Many people say it's the canary in the coal mine because it is so infectious. It's the first to pop, but it won't be the last, sadly. And we're seeing that with pertussis and whooping cough cases in Florida and elsewhere. It's not gonna be the last. And so that's why it's so important to get credible information and make informed decisions when it comes to vaccination and other healthcare interventions.
Well, and I think you said it, but I just feel like I need to say it. These declining childhood vaccination rates affect not just school kids. It affects the communities. It goes beyond the school. We're talking about healthcare systems. We're talking about families. We're talking about local economies.
You're absolutely right. There was a study that looked at, and this will be shocking when I tell you, one case of measles, tracking it down, and the resources required to respond to it, $40,000 in public resources. Because if you can imagine, you have to do tracing to figure out who's been exposed and then respond and then, you know, that type of thing. That's not even including the cost of the parents to stay home with the child. Maybe they have two children, maybe one's too young to be vaccinated. I mean, there's all kinds of things that missed work costs for adults. You know, unvaccinated adults can get measles too, and it's can be pretty miserable to serious, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's very, very costly, to your point, and avoidable. Sadly, totally preventable. So there are significant costs to the healthcare system. There's significant delays in education, costs to the schools in terms of decontamination, in terms of contact tracing, in terms of, you know, maybe setting up online learning for some and in person for others. It has a big effect, more so than just the individual, certainly.
Well, recent bipartisan polls show that 74% of voters want FDA-approved vaccines widely available. 70% are concerned about declining childhood vaccination rates. So what does that tell us about where the public actually stands?
Great question. And you're right, the majority of the public, and it's been proven in poll after poll, it continues to show up, do believe in vaccines and do want vaccines to be available to make those decisions for themselves and for their family to have access to them, and are concerned about these declines, as you mentioned. And I think that's also reflected in the polls that show that people support mandates. Because they do feel like, you know, this is concerning, these rising disease rates, the avoidable toll of preventable infectious illnesses all play a toll. They certainly affect communities, as you mentioned. It's not just in healthcare systems and the like. It's not just you individually, but it affects your community as a whole. And the majority of people are saying that, yeah, I want access. I want this to continue to be the case and continue to have this protection available.
Well, why do you think there's such a disconnect between public concern and the loudness of the anti-vaccine messaging? I mean, how did we get here? How did vaccines become a political flashpoint when historically they were widely accepted across party lines? I mean, we're going backwards.
We are sadly
Okay,
going
okay.
backwards when it comes to that. But I think some of it too is that when we don't, and because vaccines have been so successful and we've been talking about this, we don't remember what it was like to be under quarantine when there was polio spreading and they didn't know what caused it. We were learning what it's like, or the people in South Carolina are learning today what it's like to be under quarantine when it comes to measles. But we don't really remember what it was like when these diseases were widespread and what it meant and what those implications were. And sadly, the people that were permanently damaged or died at a young age from these now preventable infectious diseases. And then I also think there's the elephant in the room here is that COVID and the mandates associated with COVID vaccines really gave poured gasoline
Hold
on
your
a
thoughts.
fire of anti-vaccine sentiment.
Hold your thoughts right there. We'll come back to that. You tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holifield, and I am talking with Candace DeMatteis, again, Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at the Partnership to Fight Infectious Disease. Candace, I had to interrupt you. You want to continue your thoughts?
I was just mentioning that a lot of the pushback on vaccines, the anti-vax movement has been around for a long time, but where it really came it more into the mainstream, let's say, and bridged a divide, and became more popular amongst, typically disparate political groups, if you will, was because of COVID and the big pushback, not just on the mandates around COVID vaccines, but there's still a lot of anger just about mandates in general, mandates to stay home, mandates to homeschool or to not be in school and the after effects of that in terms of children falling behind on reading scores and math scores and the like, socialization issues with children who are now older. And so there and the economic fallout, people lost a lot of money, they weren't able to work, the financial stress that was involved in that. There is a lot of issues wrapped up in the pandemic that I think, made vaccines more of a target, and not just COVID vaccines, but vaccines more generally. And that has spilled over and kind of, like I said, poured gasoline on the fire of, we should oppose all mandates, and you shouldn't be telling me what to do, and that type of still anger, if you will, and sadly, I think it's being placed in a, it's been narrowed down to vaccines when really it was a scary time and just a lot of frustration built up over the pandemic and the angst and anxiety that was related to that and has spilled over to vaccines more generally now.
Well, what about our trusted institutions? What role do the trusted institutions, the schools, the pediatricians, the local health departments play in rebuilding confidence?
They have a tremendous role, and particularly starting in your local community. People know your schools, you know your administrators, the school board. It's so important to be able to look at them and to be able to trust them. And that's so important. A public health community, I mean, these are people in the community fighting every day and working every day to make sure that the community is safe and the community's health is improving and not at risk. There have been significant cutbacks at the federal level on funding on multiple fronts, and that's mm-hmm. made those jobs even harder, if you will. And so, again, there's been a lot of mistrust sown. Again, some of it dates back to the pandemic in these institutions. But we just encourage people, again, when you have questions about making health decisions that are so important to you and your family, to talk to a medical provider. There are some that, you know, as part of this undermining and the candidly in the anti-vax movement is, oh, you can't trust your doctor. Don't trust the medical experts. Right. And there's just, again, a lot of really false information being circulated about the motivations for people that disparage pediatricians, mm-hmm. for example, or disparage public health authorities. And that's so unfortunate because these people are dedicated to improving health and really don't deserve that.
Yeah, and it's not a partisan issue at all. All of
that's
us
right.
can get, all of us are subject to contracting any of these diseases. Would you share for the listening audience some of the more persistent myths that families hear about childhood vaccinations, and why are they so hard? They're myths. I mean, there's lots of information out there that supports that they are, but why are they so hard to dislodge?
Well, if I knew how,
I know
I didn't understand why. Yeah, that's.
I guess
the,
I'm just
secret sauce
sharing
there
my frustration.
The reality is with one of the main issues, I think, and we've talked about this a little bit. Mm. It's easy to, as I mentioned, when you're a new parent or you've got young children. I mean, we're all beginners. They don't come with an instruction manual, if you will. So we're learning as we go, and we all have our best interests. We want to protect our children. We want to make sure they're safe and healthy. And we don't have that collective understanding about the risks of these diseases oftentimes because, again, vaccines have been so successful. Vaccines are low risk and high benefit, but that doesn't mean no risk. Mm-hmm. But compared with the diseases they prevent, it's dramatically, I mean, it's multiples and multiples and multiples safer than actually putting your child at risk. And many downplaying the risk of illness, for example, aren't also sharing that the reason that the risks are lower for like contracting hepatitis B today than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, for example, is because we have such a high vaccination rate. Mm-hmm. And so if we, you know, if we slack off on that, the risks increase of those illnesses. And again, people who are disparaging vaccines won't point that out. So again, that's part of the myth is that vaccines are risky, but the diseases aren't. That's one that, you know, again, talk to a physician, talk to your grandparents, yeah. talk to, you know, an older person in the community. And they can tell you how risky these diseases are from lived experience. So that's the one that is a real challenge but continues to be perpetuated. It's like, oh, your child's really not at risk, but these vaccines are risky. And they're another one is the placebo control trial, which is a little technical, but they say, oh, these vaccines weren't tested against a placebo. Well, the reality is they were. Number one, that's not true. Number two, once you have an FDA-approved vaccine, you can't ethically have a clinical trial where you leave children exposed. That is like saying, I'm going to test a new cancer treatment for breast cancer in people who are severely ill, but half of them are going to get saline, nothing, placebo, and the other half are going to get treatment. Can you imagine how that is ethical? It is
No.
totally unethical. Yet
Yeah.
that's what they're setting up here in comparison. So, first of all, it's not true that they weren't tested against placebos. They were, and there is multiple data, and there's actually a group of scientists who have crowdsourced that data and have a long list of these placebo control trials. So that's one. They also talk about the safety. Oh, these kids were only followed for a short amount of time for the FDA approved trials. They forget that MMR has been around for
Oh,
30
Lord.
plus years and that we have millions of years and reams of data about safety that show how safe it is. So there's a lot of cherry picking of data and little points here. And then, so there's a nugget of truth, and then they extrapolate that out to, something that doesn't resemble the truth at all. But sadly, because there's a little nugget in there, people might be fooled. And that's why it's very frustrating. You can probably hear that in my voice, but it's the reality we live in. So that's why it's so very important that people talk to a trusted healthcare provider, talk to a pediatrician about your kids, talk to your own healthcare provider about yourself, talk to a pharmacist in your community. They administer a lot of vaccines and they have a lot of information about it if you don't want to set up a doctor's appointment. But follow those trusted sources for information and take the rest with a grain of salt.
Well, looking ahead, what's at stake if vaccination rates continue to decline? What's ahead? And can we reverse the trend?
The first question I would say is that history tells it's totally predictable what's going to happen with vaccination rates declining. We can see it today. But history tells us exactly what'll happen. We'll have avoidable illnesses resurge. We're seeing that with measles and whooping cough now. And sadly, we'll see more people injured and more hospitalizations and more long-term consequences and even deaths amongst children and other vulnerable populations, all avoidable. And that's the sad truth. The flip side to that is that there is opportunities that we can rebound. We can get vaccination rates back up to where they need to be to stop the spread. And we saw that in Texas. It was a big outbreak, and the public health folks on the ground worked tirelessly. Their vaccinations surged in that area, and they were able to get that outbreak under control. And so that shows again the power again of vaccination. But we can't, I mean, people in the meantime were infected, people were injured, two children lost, and one adult over the border lost their lives to measles. So we can't just say, oh, we'll drop down to 70% vaccination rate, and then we'll pump it up to 95%. That's not how it works. And it's not going to happen overnight where illness and injury from these preventable diseases doesn't occur, sadly.
For parents who are hesitant, not hostile, just hesitant. Do you have any suggestions as to how the conversations should begin?
I would suggest asking, saying that, just that. I'm hearing a lot. I've got a lot of questions. I have concerns. Can we set up a time where I can come in and talk to a pediatrician, for example? Doing it at the appointment where the vaccines are supposed to take place is one option, but really, doing it ahead of time or doing it while you're expecting or before you're expecting even, or if you have other children, that's really a good time to do it. So you're not under pressure to make a decision right then and there. But you can have those conversations. So important to ask those questions, to not be afraid to ask questions.
That's my next question.
To get your concerns answered. Yes, absolutely.
My next question, I mean, I've got a couple more questions in these last few minutes that we have. One is, okay, you got your pediatrician, you got your family doctor. For these folks that are listening, what questions should parents be asking these pediatricians and their family doctors about vaccines?
I would ask, tell me why. Why do I need to vaccinate against, you know, these diseases? Tell me what the vaccines protect my child against and why I should be concerned about those diseases. What are the potential side effects of the vaccines? What can I expect? You know, is my child going to be fussy? Is the fever likely? Those types of things. What can I do to help minimize those risks? Those are the types of questions that I would ask, which are required and which are recommended. Until you go to school, there may be daycare requirements, but until that happens, they're all recommended. They're not mandated. So that's an important consideration as well for new parents to keep in mind. But it's kind of like, how vulnerable is my child? You know, what do these vaccines, why am I vaccinating now? That's another question, because people are like, oh, this is so early. Is it really necessary early? Why are they recommended, you know, for a newborn or a 2-month-old or 1-month-old? You know, how is this kind of set about? Why is the schedule the way it is? All those are very valid questions.
I think we alluded to this, but how can families stay engaged in public health discussions without feeling intimidated? You know, those discussions can become very intimidating to a point where parents are not comfortable maintaining contact. They're not comfortable engaging in public health discussions.
That's tragic in all of this. You're right, because we all have a stake in public health and community health. And if we don't get involved, the, you know, some loud voices that maybe aren't representing the majority may win the day. So it is important for people to come in and express their viewpoint. It would be helpful if it weren't so politicized, so that we could have a calm, you know, rational discussion, if you will. And so I can understand where people are concerned that emotions may get heated. People, you know, feel passionately one way or the other. And I think that that's fair. But I think if people can come in and say, come at it from the standpoint, we all care about our children. We all want to improve health in the state of Florida or in the country or wherever you're speaking from or in your community. Let's start there and recognize, and then you could, you know, maybe that's how you start that conversation, is I'm not here to dispute what you feel, but I'm here to state the facts and where my concerns are. Because if, again, if we don't engage, if everyone is like, well, you know, the majority will win the day, that's not true, because people are so passionate on the other side that, you know, want this to end. And, you know, they have people in power that are kind of pushing this forward, even though the majority of voters are saying that's not what they want. If that remains a silent majority, the people, you know, who are being vocal are going to win the day.
Well, I got a million questions for you, but I want to pose one, and you got, I guess, 60 seconds to answer it. But how can we engage communities that have historically, they've been skeptical of vaccines, ensuring that their voices are heard while reinforcing the importance of immunization? And I know that's a big one, and you don't have much time. You got it. But do you just have any suggestions at all? I wanted to talk to you about Partners for Infectious Disease. You have to come back. Okay, we've run out of time. But any suggestions?
I would love to come back.
Okay, as to how we engage them. Now it's down to 30 seconds.
Well, again, it's so important to look for people you trust. And if you don't know in your community who that is, are there advisors in your community? Maybe it's a faith leader. Maybe it's someone else who could recommend someone.
Okay.
I think if we start there, it's so important that we're able to talk to people that we do trust and to look for expertise where that expertise lies. So in the medical community, community pharmacists are a great one. For example, there are nurse leads and health leads in faith-based communities that often can be very helpful as
well.
All right.
Well, time out.
Sorry.
Thank you, Candace. For sharing, helping us kind of cut through the noise and address the misinformation and focus on what families and teens need to know. Much appreciation to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. Get the 411 next week, same time, same place, on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.